From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The index fund. Passively managed, ultra-low cost, diversified. You know, those funds where so goes the Dow or the S&P, so goes the fund. They are investment legend John Bogle's greatest creation.
When I think about the index fund, no sales loads, no portfolio turnover. You know, you don't buy and sell every day like these active managers do. It's Wall Street's nightmare. And it still is.
Well, John Bogle is the founder of Vanguard, a company that now has more than $2.3 trillion invested in index funds. In fact, index funds are now so successful that they could be on track to own half of the entire U.S. stock market in the coming years. And that is leading to big questions, some of them asked by John Bogle himself, about a concentration of corporate ownership, voting power in the hands of a very few, about accountability and ethics. So this hour on Point, how index funds have shaped boardrooms and power on Wall Street. And you can join us. How have index funds changed your portfolio, your investment strategy? Does their ease and accessibility outweigh any potential costs or risk to them? And what do you think of this possibility that we could soon be in a market where just three investment firms, Vanguard is just one of them, that these three firms have voting control over the majority of publicly traded companies in the United States? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, today's conversation was inspired by a recent op-ed that John Bogle himself wrote in the Wall Street Journal. And in that op-ed, Bogle cited the work of John Coates, a professor of law and economics at Harvard Law School. He's also a member of the Investor Advisory Committee of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And John Coates joins us now in the studio. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
Okay, so it's a pretty startling thing to hear that index funds owned by companies like Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street could eventually be on track to own 50% of the U.S. stock market. How far are we off from that?
Well, currently in the 500 largest companies, those three own around 20%.
Already.
And it's growing, and it's growing pretty rapidly. And if you add in the next three biggest index fund providers, throw in Fidelity, who now is mostly an index provider, throw in Northern Trust and Schwab, you're getting 25 to 30%. And just project that out a few years, and you're absolutely right. We're on track to have that group own roughly half of every company.
This seems really surprising, right? Because, I mean, John Bogle created Vanguard and that first index fund in, what, the mid-70s? Is that right?
Yep.
So, and they sort of toiled in obscurity for a while. We'll talk about that in a minute. But how sudden has – or how precipitous has been this growth in index fund in the past few years?
So I think Vanguard, when it was on its own doing this, grew pretty rapidly for a startup fund, but slowly relative to the markets. BlackRock and State Street were the predecessors to BlackRock and State Street, started competing in the 80s and in the 90s. And again, continued to grow, but at a modest pace. And the real takeoff has been in the last 20 years, where there's been a kink up in the curve. If you look at the different kinds of owners of stocks, index funds are growing faster than any other kind. Mm. And they've been growing that way for about 15 years.
Okay. So let me see if I'm understanding the core concern that you have here clearly. When we're talking about index funds, I mean, like, almost anybody, as long as you have that initial amount, can buy into a fund. I mean, that's one of their great accessibility is one of John Bogle's greatest triumphs here. So, like, millions of Americans may have bought into an index fund, but you're talking about the fact that we're on track to have these funds, these three, four companies maybe who are managing these funds have ownership over 50% of the U.S. stock market in a couple of years. So the consequence of that is what? That these fund managers themselves, these individual human beings who are managing these funds, have some sort of extraordinary power over U.S. corporations?
So when an individual buys stock directly, they get votes with that, and they can control the votes. But when they go to one of the index funds, which, by the way, let me just say, I think is a great idea for average investors to do. I do it. I've done it actually since I was a teenager. I bought Vanguard shares back in the 70s because I thought it was a great idea. So I'm not in any way suggesting this is a bad thing. But the funds keep the votes. So the fund managers don't currently ask their own investors, how do you want us to vote the shares that we hold for you?
Because you'd be asking people to vote on hundreds of companies.
Frankly, thousands, actually. Because they own the whole market, right? And so as a practical matter, it wouldn't really make much sense to offer low-cost investing and then turn around and generate a huge amount of cost to try to pass those votes through. So we don't do that. But that then means, you're right, the investment managers for this small number of funds do have voting control over all the shares that their investors give them money to buy.
You've put a number on this. You've said in your work that we're talking about some 12 people.
And I think I was being generous, actually, because it really is only three funds. Now, as a practical matter, Vanguard has a staff of people, you know, dozens, more than 12, who track the votes and get information and pull it all together. But then they have a committee, and that committee makes voting decisions, and that committee is small, and there's a similar one at BlackRock and a similar process at State Street. So we're talking ultimately about a very small number of people controlling the votes for all of those shares that they own.
Of 30% of the U.S. stock market.
Of 30 plus and growing, exactly.
Wow. Okay. So we'll get deeper into what the consequences are of the power of index funds right now. But let's take a step back, though, because I feel like we should do sort of index fund 101 here.
Sure.
John Bogle did create the first index fund in 1976. What was the innovation there at that time? When we're talking about index funds, what exactly do we mean?
Sure. So actually, let me take a step even farther back. After the Great Depression, stock market investing was not thought to be a great thing. People had lost their entire life savings in the 30s. So the mutual fund industry actually was self-created. The fund industry got together and came up with some rules that said, here's a simple way we can promise people that we'll invest for them and do it well. 30 years, 40 years go by, and some financial economists, academics mainly, were looking hard at how those funds had done. And they found it hard to show that they had done better than a monkey could do. That is, you just pick randomly among the stocks out in the market. Once you got a big enough number and got diversified enough, you on average tended to do about as well as all the mutual funds that were around back
then. Is this the economics version of, you know, have enough monkeys in front of enough typewriters and you get Shakespeare?
Exactly, except that it happened year after year. And so they said, why are we paying all of these expensive portfolio managers to manage the money? We should just cut their jobs, turn it into a computer program. The computer basically would just buy the entire market. And we don't have to charge a fee anymore to pay the cost of those managers. So we can both offer the same service at a vastly lower cost. That's the Vanguard idea. And it's proven to be a success over the past 40 years. It's been able to beat most actively managed mutual funds.
Yeah. And then the key thing being for those very low costs.
For costs that are
for the individual investors.
Vastly smaller than we could possibly do the same thing for ourselves.
Yeah.
Right, if we tried to go out and buy these stocks.
Okay. So they've been very successful, but that success, though, as you were saying a little earlier, was only relatively recently, right? It was a couple of decades in which they were toiling in obscurity, right? I mean, I think I was reading that when Vanguard offered its first index fund in, again, the mid-70s, that, you know, the major investment houses in the United States were kind of laughing at Vanguard and John Bogle, saying, why would anyone want this?
Yes, and it's taken a long time for the math to prove itself over and over and over enough that now most – I would say most financial academics, people who study this stuff for a living, now believe Vanguard is right. So that's the first point. It took a while for them to convert. And then the more important delay was you're talking about retail investors. You're talking about people who – are not professionals. This is not what they do. They don't tend to like to focus on this because they kind of know they're not good at it. So for them to take in the idea that they should just turn their money over to somebody who's just going to buy every company, as opposed to somebody who says, oh, I know a really good idea for an investment. We should buy this company. There's no sales sort of embedded in that index fund pitch. It's just low fees, Whereas the active managers, they're very good at telling stories about how their plan is going to turn out to be better. And so it's just taken a long time, I think, to push into the retail world to get individual investors to accept the idea that they're better off not trying to beat the market.
Right. I mean, it takes all the magic out of
it. Makes it boring.
those guys seeking alpha all the time, right? So, but now what we're talking about here is that there's this, because of the size, the enormous size of these index funds now. You're raising questions about whether or not they're an unalloyed good anymore. John Bogle certainly, I mean, you got his attention. He wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal. But did anyone ever think that so much power would be concentrated among such few funds?
I think because the takeoff has been relatively recent, last 15 years or so, I don't think people have focused on the governance implications, the fact that they're getting so much voting power as they grow. The one other thing to say that hadn't quite come out is when you run an index fund, there's enormous benefits to size, to scale, because you can spread the cost of the computer program and the paperwork and the tax filings over a larger number of investors. So in the old days, when money was more frequently managed actively, funds didn't tend to grow quite to the same scale. Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street and the other indexers are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Okay.
And so that's what's generating the governance issue.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds to go here before a break. But again, it's sort of that index fund 101 level.
Yep.
When we're talking about corporate governance and the decisions that the fund managers, as the representative of these funds, are now able to make.
Yep.
For corporations, what kind of decisions are we talking about?
Well, the most kind of extreme example would be, let's suppose there's a proposal for a company to sell itself, a merger or an acquisition. Vanguard and the other indexers say yes or no to that. That's a huge decision, and that's currently within their control.
Okay. And also, because they're index funds, they might be saying yes or no to companies in the same industry as well.
You
so
got
questions
it.
About competition there. So we're talking about the burgeoning power of index funds in the United States stock market and the implications that has for corporate governance. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the burgeoning size and power and influence of index funds in the American stock market. John Bogle, the father of index funds, the founder of Vanguard, recently wrote in the Wall Street Journal that if historical trends continue, a handful of giant institutional investors such as Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street will one day hold voting control of virtually every large U.S. corporation, a really interesting outcome to an idea, the index fund that was supposed to democratize people's access at low cost to the American stock market. So what are the implications of that? That is what we're wrestling with this hour. And joining us to do so is John Coates. He's professor of law and economics at Harvard Law School, where he teaches corporate governance, mergers and acquisitions and finance. We'll get another view here in just a minute. But Professor Coates, let's explore a little bit more about what you're saying the implications might be. You know, as we said in the previous segment, you're saying that there's like this problem of 12, that the main individuals who are managing these funds, as Bogle is saying, may have voting control over virtually every large U.S. corporation in the coming years. So what are the implications of that? Let's use the airlines as an example.
Sure. So you can put the concerns that this raises into a couple categories.
Yeah.
One is traditional worries about market concentration, like the airline industry. There's always a concern they're not competing enough and as a result raising prices higher than they actually could justify based on the costs to them. And when every airline is principally owned by the same small number of index funds, that creates maybe an incentive for the airlines to say, why are we competing with each other? Our owners own all of us. If I steal revenue from you by cutting costs, then that's only going to hurt the shareholders who own both of us. So we should just stop competing as much.
I mean, have we seen any evidence of that happening, or is it just purely theoretical?
So this is not my research, but I would say there are other academics who have done studies to suggest that, yes, in fact, that increases in index ownership of the airlines have correlated at least with increases in profitability of those airlines and a sort of a reduction in price competition among them.
Well, the correlation, but maybe not the causation.
Possibly not causation. Very hard to tease out. And I will say on the other side of it, they're academics fiercely contesting that. So that – but that's one possible – I mean, you certainly see how it could happen. You have 12 people. They control all the airlines. As an owner, they don't necessarily have the same interests that they have as consumers of air travel. They might very well want them to raise prices collectively, even though that might help one more than the others. It's going to benefit all of them at the expense of air travel.
Okay, but here's the little pushback that I'll offer. I mean, index funds by definition are supposed to they're passive, quote unquote, passively managed funds, and as we heard in that tape from John Bogle himself earlier in the hour, they're in it for the long haul, right? So aren't those actually good things in terms of the investors who have deep interest in the operations of a corporation? Because a lot of the current complaints about the American capitalistic system is that we have a lot of investors who are demanding things on the short term.
Yeah. So I don't want to, again, suggest that I think indexing is bad. I think it's mostly good. It's mostly good because it helps people invest cheaply and well. It's also good for the reason you say, which is in principle their interests are long-term and aligned with everyone. I will say except for possibly the consumer point I was making a second ago, where long-term it's not clear whether even that plays – how that plays out. But certainly – but here's the problem. We don't know. There's no disclosure right now. There's no transparency into how these funds are talking to airlines, banks, oil companies, go down the list. They do meet with them and they say things to them and they communicate what they want. And maybe it's great. Maybe it's exactly what we would want as a society and maybe not. But we don't know right now. There are no laws requiring the big index funds to tell the world what they're saying in these meetings. And there's nobody taking minutes. There's nobody in the room.
You know, it's – I have to say it's just – let's see if I can articulate the irony that's bouncing around in my head right now, that the very instrument that was created to – you know, as something of a democratizing tool for the market to give average folks like you and me access to the stock market and has done so – has led us to the point where we have, as you're saying, this tiny number of managers of those funds, those tiny, tiny number of individuals with this consolidated, concentrated power over every major company in the United States. I mean, it just – it kind of – it boggles the mind almost.
It does. I mean, but it sort of makes sense in a way because if you're democratizing, that means you're raising money from millions of people. And then what you're doing is the only way they can do it, the only way they can invest is to transfer control over to somebody for them. And then the most efficient way to do that is a small number because they can do it for everybody all at once really cheaply. Yeah. And that then produces this side effect.
So we'll talk about transparency more in a minute and maybe, you know, in terms of the way forward, is there a way to get the interests and desires of the millions of us as individual investors in these index funds bubbling up to those managers themselves? We'll talk about that in a minute. But John, stand by here for a second because I want to bring in Todd Gormley into this conversation. He's joining us today from St. Louis, Missouri. He's a professor of finance at the Olin Business School at the Washington University in St. Louis. And he's co-author of many studies on index funds such as Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, the Effect of Passive Investors on Activism. Todd Gormley, welcome to On Point.
Oh, happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So this is a really interesting and eye-opening idea about the big power of index funds here. Are you as concerned as John Coates is saying possibly we should be about the impact of these funds on American corporations?
You know, I'm not sure. I think it's reasonable to ask whether this concentration of influence over such a large chunk of the economy might have some potential downsides. And if so, what are the ways in which we can mitigate those? I think that's a totally fair question to ask and think about. However, I think what we don't want to forget is that this increased concentration of influence might also have some beneficial effects. Historically, the concern has been that investors are not exerting enough influence over managers or monitoring managers enough to make sure that they're working in their interests. And the reason for that is that if you're an investor and you own 0.1% of a company and you go out of your way to exert a lot of effort to monitor the manager and make sure they're working hard for your interest, and that somehow improves the company's value by $1 million, because you only own 0.1% of that company, you only benefit personally through an increase in value of $1,000. Most of the benefits go to other investors. And this disconnect has really caused this concern that investors don't exert enough influence. And sort of a potential upside of the growth of these index providers and their concentrated ownership is that because they own large stakes in these companies, they have a greater incentive to monitor the managers on our behalf as investors to ensure that they're working hard towards our interests.
So does that mean that they themselves could become more active or activist in shareholders?
Yes, to some degree. There are certain things that these index providers do and do not do. They primarily engage managers through voice in terms of communicating to them what they view as sort of best practices for a company and through their votes. But they aren't like your typical activists, like a hedge fund that would try to accumulate positions in a company and engage in a proxy fight to put their own directors on the board. That's not something that these index providers have done in the past or are expected to really do.
But then, for example, I mean, there are some very famous activist investors in the American market. If say there is an activist investor that comes along, I don't know, a Carl Icahn type, who has an idea of how they want to change the company, and they just really need to get like Vanguard on board, and they'll suddenly have enough votes to push the idea through. Is that a positive or a negative?
Yeah, it actually can be a positive. So this is something that my research has looked at, is whether it's sort of the growth of these index providers and this increased concentration ownership might actually benefit the activists, right? So in the past, if Carl Icahn had approached a company because he thinks it's underperforming and it's making the wrong choices, he'd have to try to convince or win over the other investors. Now, if the investor base is spread across thousands and thousands of investors that each only own a tiny fraction of the firm's shares, that's a much harder thing for Carl Icahn to do. And many of those investors may not be paying attention. But nowadays, Carl Icahn can approach the company and speak to Vanguard, BlackRock, State Street, and their governance divisions. And now you've spoken to 15 to 20% of the ownership. And these are very attentive investors that are more likely to be informed about what's going on with the company and potentially responsive. And my research shows that, in fact, when a company is held by more of these index investors, the activists appear to be more successful in getting their reforms made.
You know, but every time I hear that all you need to do is approach a small number of individuals who are managing these funds, I have the image of sort of dark and smoky back rooms where the oligarchy meet to make decisions on the behalf of the 300 million of the rest of us. I mean, I think this is exactly what John Bogle was getting at in his Wall Street Journal op-ed when he says, you know, that the big three, Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street, when they own such a huge portion of the stock market, he says, I do not believe that such concentration would serve the national interest.
And I think that's a totally fair concern. And I would agree with Professor Coates that more accountability, more disclosure about what the communications are that these index investors have with management would be good. Sort of more rules on what the fiduciary duties of these investors are could be beneficial as well.
Okay, so John Coates, you've been very patient here, but now talk to each other, John and Todd.
Sure.
How do we move forward here? What's your response to what Todd's saying?
Well, I think we're basically pretty much in agreement on the challenge. It's a dilemma, really, is what it is. We have a wonderful thing, the index fund, which we want to protect and preserve. In fact, I jokingly, when I present my paper, I call it How to Keep Vanguard Alive for the Next 30 Years. I want to protect it. But on the other hand, you've got 12 people in the room making decisions and very little transparency around how they're being made. There's this room for suspicion at a minimum, and possibly conflicts of interest, for example, between the managers of the funds and either their own investors or society more broadly to occur. So Vanguard already is sort of pointed the way to some things that could be done. So for example, Vanguard, as I mentioned, has a committee. On that committee, they keep off all their sales staff. They do that voluntarily, I think, as a way of showing their good faith to the world, but they're not required to. And another index provider wouldn't be obliged to do the same thing. So they mitigate one conflict, which is just between their sales goals and their voting power. But there are other kinds of conflicts that you can imagine, especially if you think about an index provider that's bolted onto Goldman Sachs or pick another major diversified financial institution. If one of those really were to have enormous practical control through votes and also have a bunch of other businesses, again, you can see room there for conflicts of interest. Currently, there's nothing really to stop them from exploiting those opportunities.
Well, John and Todd, stand by here for just a second, because we've got some callers who want to join us. And just to remind folks, we are talking about the burgeoning power and concentration of influence amongst America's largest index funds, including those – well, especially those run by companies like Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street. And given the fact that millions of Americans have at least part of their 401ks, for example, invested in these index funds, this is something that touches a lot of people. So let's go to Wiley, who's calling from New Orleans. Wiley, you're on the air.
Hello. I just had a question. I was wondering if having so many shares locked up in just a few funds could actually increase volatility on the market by lowering the volume of shares that's traded every day, and how that could affect, you know, price discovery, and if there's any kind of feedback loops that could get triggered by that in the market.
Wiley, great question. Todd Gormley, what do you think?
So there has been some research on whether there might be effects on volatility or price efficiency. And the preliminary work on this does seem to suggest that the growth of ETFs or index investors could be increasing volatility, could be reducing price discovery. So this is something to think about, and whether there are things that could be done to mitigate these potentially harmful effects of the growth of indexers.
John Coates?
Yeah, I agree. There's a related point, which is there's also good research that shows simply adding a company to some of the major indexes generates huge inflows into the stock, because the index just buys a lot of shares for its own investors. And that actually has a price impact. It actually pushes up the price around the time of the addition to the index. So it's actually, so indexing not only is affecting volatility and not only affecting governance, but also actually affecting value, the price that these shares trade at.
Is it an artificial inflation then?
Well, it depends on how you think about it. Arguably, both prices can't be right. The price before it got added and the price after is only reflecting who owns it. It's not strictly liquidity positive effect. So it's showing a mispricing. It's not clear whether it's right before or after. But in any event, indexing is having a direct effect on the markets.
Right. Well, let's go to Deborah, who's calling from Watertown, Connecticut. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi. I think it was Spider-Man who said, with great power comes great responsibility. And I would like to argue to John and his peers, you're not living up to that responsibility specifically. We have top executives who are fundamentally employees who are being paid like entrepreneurs. Two, when they fail in performance, we have people who are clearly being fired for poor performance walking away with multi-million dollar compensation packages. Three, we are taking a very short-term view towards performance. And when you talk about your responsibility to shareholders, it's all short-term performance. There's no appropriate investment in long-term performance. And finally, I feel that there's a focus on shareholder value and executives to the exclusion of other legitimate constituency.
Yeah. So, Deborah, thank you so much for your call. I just want to correct you one thing. If you're talking about John, as in John Coates, my guest today, he's calling for more transparency in how these index funds work. But you bring up a bunch of really important points. And Todd Gormley, let me turn to you for a second. I think at the heart of what Deborah is saying is that there's still this fundamental concern that corporations are operating in a way that focuses on shareholder value versus the overall maybe societal benefit and societal value that they should be focusing on, and that investors themselves, and especially in the case of these giant index funds, aren't doing enough to push corporations in the societal value direction.
Right. So, I mean, that's a big debate in the literature as to what should be the proper focus of managers in terms of, is it just the shareholders that matter or is it all stakeholders that matter? So I view that kind of as a very separate issue in terms of governance.
Well, we're going to pick up that thought, though, and explore it a little bit more when we come back. We are talking about the huge and enormous influence that index funds now have on the U.S. stock market and U.S. corporations. I'm joined today by Todd Gormley and by John Coates. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about index funds this hour and the fact that several funds owned by, let's say, three companies, Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street, are on track to owning 50% of the United States stock market in the coming years. And the questions, the big questions that that concentrated ownership raises when it comes to corporate governance and other major issues in terms of how business is done in the United States. And I'm joined today by John Coates. He's a professor of law and economics at Harvard Law School, where he teaches corporate governance, mergers and acquisitions. He studied the concentrated ownership in index funds quite a bit. Todd Gormley also joins us. He's professor of finance in the Olin Business School at the Washington University in St. Louis. And John Coates, before the break, we had a caller calling in asking about, you know, she used Spider-Man, I think, as a wonderful analogy about that. With great power comes great responsibility, and not seeing enough of that responsibility being exercised by these fund managers, for example. And in fact, we have another comment on our website from someone calling themselves Modern Publius, who says, if the index fund managers are poised to have controlling share in companies, and if they are truly representing the interests of so many average investors, could they not also be leveraged to make those companies to do things in the investors' actual real-world interests beyond just making money?
I think those are exactly the right kinds of questions that we need to be asking ourselves and asking the index providers. My general belief is that the index funds take their governance role seriously, and they do, for example, on pay, which is one of the topics the caller asked about. They're more likely to push for long-term rewards as opposed to short-term rewards that may come from other kinds of pay packages. But having said that, I do think they could do more. I think they could do more to inform us, the people that are handing our money over to them and giving them this power, and actually elicit our views on a range of voting issues. Technology makes it, at least in principle, possible now to do that. You could have an app that by which ordinary investors not only could select, I want to invest this way, but also here are the kinds of issues that I care about and here's the way I want you to be voting for me. I think that's completely feasible. It'll be a lot of work to do in the details, but I think that's the kind of thing that great power ought to bring with it, great accountability in that form.
Does that not, though, sort of come into conflict with the fundamental, quote unquote, passivity that index funds are supposed to have? I mean, if you're adding sources of information for fund managers and how they should behave, it's not so passive anymore.
Well, again, I'm not suggesting we push out every decision. Yeah. I think that would, in fact, subvert the whole idea of a low-cost passive fund. But I do think more input, structured, So, for example, on climate change, the entire oil industry is wrestling with this. Vanguard, State Street, BlackRock have an influence over those companies. Their investors care about climate change. You could frame easily a couple of choices. Do we want more ESG orientation, environmental stewardship and governance orientation? Do we want them to be more – do we want the oil companies to disclose more about their plans to live in a world in which climate change regulation is serious or not? That would be an example. And I don't think, again, you need to get into the details of how the oil companies will do it or what the Vanguard will be voting on every single vote to have more transparency.
Well, Todd Gormley, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, if I can jump in here, I would also want to point out that there has been a shift among these index providers in how they view these issues over time. And I think this has been in response to investors' desire for them to care about this. So, for example, if you go back to the early 2000s and their publicly disclosed voting guidelines on what issues they consider to be important and what they are focusing on, you'll actually find a paragraph where they explicitly say, we are not interested in issues regarding corporate social responsibility. We don't view that as in our purview. You will no longer find that paragraph in their public voting guidelines, and instead they're actually being more vocal now that these are issues that they think are important and that they are trying to push companies to think about. Now, whether they're having an impact or how sort of forceful they are being in their engagement with managers about these issues, that's an open question.
Well, let's bring in another voice here. Michelle Singletary joins us now. She's with us from Bowie, Maryland. She's a financial journalist for The Washington Post and author of the nationally syndicated column The Color of Money. Michelle Singletary, it's great to have you back on Point. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, we really wanted to have you because, ultimately, one of the greatest powers of these index funds is that a lot of just average folk are invested in them. So when you first read John Bogle's sort of, I don't want to call it a warning cry necessarily, but he's raising questions about the big power of these index funds. What did you think? What does it mean for regular folks?
Well, initially, my heart stopped. I was thinking, is the father of the index fund saying that they're not good? But as I read his editorial, and it's true to who he is, I think he has always looked at the regular investor and wanting to give them a product that is going to work for them and is cost efficient for them. And so I think what he's saying is, listen, I created this vehicle for you all to save and have low cost. That's great. But now let's think about it's gone. It's the big gorilla now, and we got to make sure that it's being handled and done in a way that still looks out for investors. So at the end, I was thinking, whew, thank you. And then but there's only going to be a certain quality of investor that is going to read this and take it to heart and really look at it. Because the fact of the matter is, we still don't have enough people investing for their retirement. And I work on the ground with regular investors who aren't calling into programs like this because your guys are so smart. They don't even know what's in their portfolio. Quite frankly, they don't even know that they're investing in a Vanguard index fund. And that's, for me, that is very concerning, that they don't know how they're investing. So this argument for them is so lofty. It's so over their heads. But it is important because we do need to make sure that they don't get so big that they do not operate in the interest of regular investors.
Right. So, point taken, Michelle. And that's why we really wanted to have you on to sort of reground it in terms that are meaningful and sort of remind us why should we care about this. But given what we've been talking about, that these very funds that so many millions of Americans are invested in, and I hear you when you say that you want to see more people have the opportunity to do so, but that's leading to this concentration of ownership. I mean, what would be your argument to folks listening about why they should care?
Well, because, I actually am looking at it from a different point of view. He talked about sort of the policy and influence on corporations. I'm a little bit worried about the pricing, because when you get big and you have all this concentration, then there may not be as much of a they may not want to stay with what Bogle, the reason why he started in the first place is to provide low cost, because it's just like with the airlines. I'm scared to death Southwest is going to, now make us pay for both our bags, because when you have less in the market, you have fewer choices, and they can kind of price things in a way that you still have to pay. And so for me, I'm more worried that they'll get so big that they won't adhere to why they started in the first place, which is to provide low-cost ways for people to invest.
Right. So Todd Gormley, does Michelle have a legitimate concern there?
You know, I'm a little bit less worried about the cost in terms of there is still quite a bit of competition among these index providers to get investors to go put their money into their particular fund. And the main way in which they compete with each other is with respect to cost. And in fact, Fidelity, in its recent push to expand its indexing, has pushed the cost of its funds down to zero. They're offering zero-cost funds to investors now.
Mm. Well, you know what? I want to let some callers in here to have their say. So let's go to Nancy, who's calling from New Bern, North Carolina. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. My concern, my question would be, at what point do these select group of fund managers not only influence the corporations that they own, but through them, through political action committees or through political contributions, do they actually affect governance?
Mm. Yeah, Nancy, I really appreciate that question. John Coates, your answer?
I think it's a great question. As listeners probably know, Citizens United, a court case a few years ago, let companies into the electoral process for the first time in a long time. And with concentration in the index funds, you now have a two-tier, very new potential path for political influence. I think if anything, I would like to see – this is my own personal preference now – the index funds asking companies to pull back from electoral influence. I think that's generally a better direction for the country. But the very fact that we could have that fight, what should the index funds be telling Exxon about Exxon's use of its influence in our electoral system only drives home the point that I'd like everybody to keep in mind, which is how powerful the index funds are. Traditionally, they've not taken a strong position on corporate political activity. I would like them to do so. That's the kind of question I think they could get informed by asking us.
Yeah.
That is, their consumers. And I think they could do that at a low cost, for example. Mm-hmm. So I agree with the caller's concern, and it's one of the ones that that motivated me to focus on this issue.
Well, let's go to Noah, who's calling from Greenville, Tennessee. Noah, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick comment kind of following up on the previous caller in terms of the concentration of ownership and the effect on corporate competition. You could see a scenario where perhaps you end up with a consolidation eventually of these multiple index funds into perhaps one or two, and you end up with a situation that's more akin to monopsony, kind of like what we have with the Pentagon, where you have one buyer and very little competition. Thanks.
Yeah. Noah, thank you for your call. Todd Gormley, is Noah right to ask about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is certainly something that we are looking at in terms of, does the growth of these index providers and the concentration lead to potentially anti-competitive behaviors? And I would just reiterate what John said earlier, that this is something that's very much debated right now among academics. There are some that argue that they find evidence that their growth is leading to anti-competitive behavior, and there are many others that very strongly disagree with that and do not find the evidence to be quite compelling. So I think the jury is still very much out on that issue.
Hmm. John Coates, we've just got a couple of minutes left here, and I just want to briefly ask you, what's your primary suggestion for what these index funds ought to do? I think you've touched on it before, but it's worth reiterating, because I appreciate you bringing up to this table this concern that we have, this consolidation of ownership and therefore influence. So what to do about it?
I think we should make mandatory some of the good things they're already doing. So, for example, I think they should be required to separate their voting activity from their sales activity. They should separate their voting activity from other kinds of financial interests that the managers might have. That's the first minimal step.
And what would that be federal regulation that would require it?
Ideally, yes. I think it would be SEC-led, because these are these are global institutions. Yeah. So these are not things that can be regulated, I think, state by state very effectively. And then beyond that, I think more transparency around how they engage companies. I think in a way, they have the kind of influence that governmental institutions do. And we expect our governmental institutions to be open, and we have sunshine laws, and we have a whole process around how they form rules. I actually think that's the right kind of model to have in mind for how they start to take positions on governance issues.
Yeah.
Climate change, for example. Vanguard could put up a proposal. We plan to take the following position over the next 5 years about climate change. What do our investors think?
Mm.
And they could get comments, and then they could look at those comments. Now, most people who don't know they vote, they don't even know they invest in Vanguard, as Michelle was pointing out, they would be silent. But there would be a number of people who would give them some information, and I think that's a way we ought to think about going.
Yeah. Todd Gormley, your thoughts on what you would have these funds do?
Yeah, well, I'm in agreement with John here. I think separating voting activity from their other business interests or formalizing that separation is a good thing. More transparency is a good thing. In general, I think the focus should be on identifying what are the potential harmful effects and what are the ways in which we can mitigate them that doesn't harm the sort of beneficial side of indexers in their growth.
Mm. Well, Todd Gormley is professor of finance at the Olin Business School at the Washington University in St. Louis. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And John Coates, professor of law and economics at Harvard Law School, where he teaches corporate governance, mergers and acquisitions, and finance. Thank you for joining us as well.
It was a delight. Thank you very much.
Well, so Michelle Singletary, we've got about 2.5 minutes left here, and I really wanted to ground this conversation back at the level of the average investor like you and me. And what I want to ask you is, okay, index funds aside, we've seen insane market volatility in the past couple of days, right? With the stock market going over a cliff, 700-point losses, things like that. So for folks listening that's what they're worried about right now, what would you tell them?
If you've got some long time to retirement, you've got to try to find some way to not be so upset and concerned and pull out, because over time we know that investing in the market, being diversified, is the way to grow your money. Your biggest threat isn't the volatility of the market right now. The biggest threat for you is inflation. So that means your dollar has to grow, and it can't grow in your mattress, and it can't grow in a simple savings account. So try what you can. Turn the TV off. Go sit down. Do some meditation. If you've got a thought-out financial plan, you're investing in your 401k, your thrift savings plan, just look down the road. Try as best as you can to not worry about what's going on today.
Yeah,
because if you do, you're going to lock in your losses. And we found out that during the recession, lots of people jumped out and they missed out on the upside when the market went back up.
But what about for the folks who, I mean, thinking of 2008, 2009, who didn't really have a choice, though? I mean, every time the market gets shaky like it is now, those are the folks I worry about, that their time horizon is 6 months or a year or 2 years from now.
Well, you ought to have money that is not so risky right now. You've got to have 5 to 10 years if you're about to retire in money that is not, you know, subject to all this volatility. Now, you still got to have a great amount of your portfolio in a position to grow. So in that case, you may be too risky, so then you do have to do some reallocations. But for those who are not in that position, just be calm. And if you are in that position, this is a good time to find a fee-only financial planner, have them look at your portfolio. Where can you move your money to make sure some of it's safe for the short term, 5 to 10 years, maybe 5 to 8 years, so that you won't have to, you know, experience a lot of loss.
Yeah. So just got 10 seconds left. Will you forgive me if I say that I did look at my portfolio because I just couldn't help it this past week?
It's okay. If you can look and not react, I look all the time. If you can do that, but if you can't, if it's going to make you lose sleep, then don't look.
Okay. Well, Michelle Singletary, author of The Color of Money, the personal finance column, thank you so much as always.
Welcome.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.